if we just move forward with just a straight repeal with the promise that we'll get to it in 2 years. I think that that adds just greater uncertainty.
An attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act is dead for now. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 18th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state lawmakers look for ways to boost state revenue.
Increasing the motor fuel tax, I think, is probably the lowest hanging fruit that we could find in Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
When the Republican health care reform bill collapsed last night, President Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell switched to a repeal and delay plan. They proposed to vote immediately on repealing the Affordable Care Act and then give themselves 2 years to craft a replacement. But with a tweet this morning, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski may have doomed the idea. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Of the Republican senators who oppose repeal without replacement, Shelley Moore Capito tweeted her rejection early, around 7:30 a.m. She said it would be bad for her constituents in West Virginia, especially those who benefited from the Affordable Care Act's expansion of Medicaid. Senator Susan Collins of Maine tweeted in about 90 minutes later. She said repeal without replacement would cause turmoil in the insurance markets. Senator Lisa Murkowski was the third to reject it, judging by the Twitter timestamps.
I'm concerned that if we just move forward with just a straight repeal with the promise that we'll get to it in 2 years, trust us on this, I think that that adds just greater uncertainty into an area and a market that is already chaotic.
Republican leaders can only afford to lose 2 votes. Back in 2015, Murkowski did vote for a similar repeal and delay bill. Here's what she said then.
It's not affordable for us in Alaska, and that's why I support the bill that repeals the ACA and wipes out these harmful impacts. I simply cannot, we can't stand by and see these premiums shoot through the roof.
Murkowski says the facts on the ground are different now. She meant that Alaska's insurance market was healthier then. A more obvious difference is that President Obama was in office then. As expected, he vetoed that bill. Murkowski didn't declare how she would have voted on the replacement bill Republicans unveiled last week. It had less generous subsidies for people who buy their own plans, and it would have ended the high federal match for Medicaid expansion. It also had special funds for Alaska's insurance market. Senator Dan Sullivan says he would have voted to proceed on the Republican replacement bill. He says he was working to make it better and looking forward to the amendment process.
My frustration, which is pretty strong right now, is that to me we're close on a bill that does, you know, this repeal and repair Obamacare, but that I was very confident would protect Alaska's interests.
The state has calculated the Republican proposal would have lessened its revenues from Medicaid by $3 billion and ended the expansion that has insured 34,000 Alaskans. Sullivan says he's been working on a plan to cover that population. Murkowski says she wants to begin right away to find solutions for the problems of the Affordable Care Act with open, bipartisan hearings. Sullivan says he's fine with bipartisanship, but he doesn't think Senate Democrats have any reasonable solutions.
Their big idea right now, when they talk on the Sunday talk shows and when they talk on the Senate floor, is single payer. The amount of money it would cost the United States government to run a single-payer healthcare system is enormous.
If McConnell does hold a vote next week to proceed with a repeal and delay bill, Sullivan says he's a yes. If Murkowski remains a no, it's not clear it will pass. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A budget blueprint in the U.S. House is reviving hopes for Alaskans who want to see the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge open to oil drilling. The budget plan doesn't actually discuss ANWR. It calls on the House Natural Resources Committee to find $5 billion in cuts or revenues over a decade. Environmental groups are sounding the alarm, saying that's a backhanded way of directing the committee to put ANWR lease revenues in the budget package. Matt Shukaro, spokesman for Representative Don Young, says that's the congressman's take on it, too. Alaska's congressional delegation has been trying for decades to open the so-called 1002 area of the refuge. Adding it to the budget could be a way to get the legislation through the Senate with just 51 votes rather than the usual 60. The proposal, though, remains controversial in the Senate, where even some Republicans oppose the idea. A House committee plans to take it up tomorrow. In a year when lawmakers could agree on little, a proposal to triple the state's motor fuel tax stands out. Legislators from both parties say the tax may be needed to support construction and maintenance of roads, airports, ferries, and ports. But Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on why the bill didn't pass.
Lawmakers have passed fewer bills in 2017 than any year in the state's history, but it seemed that Senate Bill 25 stood one of the best chances of passing. The bill to increase Alaska's tax of 8 cents per gallon of gasoline to 16 cents this month and 24 cents in a year was described by some senators as a user fee that would offset the growing costs to maintain roads. Eagle River Senator Anna McKinnon hasn't endorsed the bill. She notes that those who commute on Glen Highway from her district would pay more in taxes. But she acknowledges that they benefit from state transportation funding.
We drive a considerable distance on that highway, and it costs a whole lot of money to replace that.
The bill became caught in the wider debate over a plan to balance future state budgets. The bill was expected to raise $80 million a year. That's about 3% of the gap between what the state spends and what it raises in taxes, fees, and oil royalties. McKinnon says the Senate majority ultimately chose to focus on a different bill, Senate Bill 26. That measure would draw money from permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. The Senate and House haven't agreed on that either.
We did not want to do death by 1,000 taxes, by 1,000 cuts. We wanted to take the largest item that could help Alaskans and our economy, and that's SB 26.
Along with residents in areas with long commutes, the bill also was opposed by airlines and cargo carriers. They say it will make Anchorage uncompetitive with other airports. It received strong backing from businesses that depend on the roads being in good condition. Anchorage Democratic Representative Matt Klayman says he's disappointed the bill didn't pass.
What's the low-hanging fruit on the revenue picture? Increasing the motor fuel tax, I think, is probably the lowest-hanging fruit that we could find in Alaska.
Klayman attributes the bill's failure to the Senate. He says House members passed bills that would raise more revenue, including an income tax.
I think the House was doing everything we could to let the Senate know, say, listen, go ahead and pass the motor fuel tax, and we're very receptive to passing that as well.
Klayman says the Republican-led Senate majority hasn't adjusted to the fact that Alaskans elected an independent governor and a House majority that's mostly Democrats.
You look and see why isn't legislation moving through the Senate, and I think maybe at some level the Senate hasn't really come to accept that there are changes happening in Alaska that are reflected both in who is our governor and the House majority.
But McKinnon says Alaskans also have reelected a Senate majority that's opposed to taxes. She says it's the House that isn't used to governing. She says the House had tried to link bills rather than judging each bill on its own.
The House has been leveraging individual pieces of legislation, from my perspective, to get their way. And that is not how policy should be developed. Policy, in my opinion, should be developed based on the facts for any individual piece of legislation, not tied to another piece.
It's not clear if the motor fuel tax could be passed in a special session later this year, or if the bill will have to wait until next year. The legislature has passed a total of 30 bills this year. The previous low was in 2011, when it passed 39 bills. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a big payout in a police officer discrimination lawsuit against the city of Anchorage.
Al Kenny and Ellie Feliciano were two very experienced and well-respected undercover drug cops.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided for all the training programs, providing students with housing, food, books, and tools. Learn more by calling 1-800-733-JOBS. This message sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
Alaska is on course to be the first state in the country to allow customers to use cannabis inside regulated businesses. During a meeting in Fairbanks last week, the state's Marijuana Control Board approved a proposal laying out guidelines for what's called on-site consumption, eating or smoking cannabis products inside licensed retail shops. The measure would let retail businesses open up areas to use cannabis provided they meet criteria like a ventilation system, a separate consumption area, and ensuring people aren't bringing in outside product. Local governments will still get a say in developing their own additional regulations, such as bans on indoor smoking. The measure is far from final. After a 60-day comment period, the Marijuana Control Board will consider amendments, and then, according to the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office's Director, Erica McConnell, vote on whether or not to adopt the final framework. On-site consumption has been a vexing issue for local governments in Alaska, particularly areas with lots of tourism. Rules against public consumption have essentially made it legal to buy cannabis, but not legal to use outside of private residences. Last week, the Anchorage Assembly passed a resolution in supporting state regulations for on-site consumption, citing customers and tourists with nowhere to go. Though a growing number of states have set up or are in the process of implementing recreational cannabis industries, none have set up a system for allowing on-site consumption inside businesses or Amsterdam-style pot cafes. The municipality of Anchorage faces a big financial loss in a lawsuit by two ex-officers who say they faced racial discrimination at the Anchorage Police Department. The two former undercover drug detectives won their case, and a jury verdict from May says the city has to pay more than $2 million. More recently, the judge presiding over the case also ordered the city to pay more for what he called vexatious and bad faith conduct that ultimately Anchorage property owners will pay for in taxes. The judge goes so far as to say the APD bungled a completely separate case, a criminal investigation of the Alaska National Guard, in its failed attempt to fight the discrimination allegations. Alaska Public Media reporter Casey Grove is here to help us understand all of this. Hi, Casey.
Hi, Lori.
So how did this get started?
Well, back in 2009, Alvin Kennedy and Eliza Feliciano were working at the APD as undercover drug detectives. They had both been on the force for about 20 years. They filed a racial discrimination complaint and later a hostile work environment lawsuit because they say it's because they aren't white. Kennedy is African American and Feliciano is Hispanic. Their attorney, Ken Legacki, says his clients got worse assignments than the white guys, among other mistreatment by the department.
Al Kenny and Ellie Feliciano were two very experienced and well-respected undercover drug cops, two of the best cops the city of Anchorage ever had.
Legacki and later Superior Court Judge Frank Fiffner say the police department tried and failed with frivolous internal investigations of the two men to get rid of them.
Does all of this come up in the trial later?
Well, there are actually two trials. The first one ended in a hung jury. In the second, the jury found in favor of the two ex-cops and against the municipality of Anchorage.
Okay, Casey, so the jury awards each of the men more than $1 million, but you said the judge tacked on even more money?
Yeah, and that's the recent thing here. He tacked on about $250,000 each, and Judge Fiffner had some very strong words for the city attorneys and the APD in his July 5th order. Fiffner writes that the municipality got caught using, quote, dirty tricks, and he compares the case to Watergate, even saying that former President Richard Nixon, quote, learned this lesson the hard way. The judge writes that he hopes the city and police department have also learned their lesson, but he notes that the taxpayers of Anchorage are the ones that are going to have to foot the bill.
Well, what did the municipality have to say in response?
Municipal Attorney Bill Falsey says the city is reviewing prior practices and does not plan to appeal, which means they're going to pay the money. Still, Falsey says the city disagrees with many of the judge's characterizations, and he wouldn't say more than that. Legacki, the winning attorney on the other side, says the city still isn't getting the point. Here he is one more time.
Well, if you really believe that, then obviously nothing's going to change. It's scary to think that even now these people don't recognize the gravity of what occurred, because somebody should really take a serious look at it. Who investigates the investigators, right?
A big issue with this case that Legacki and Judge Fifner point to is its connection to the APD investigation of the Alaska National Guard. Fifner says the APD wanted so badly to win the lawsuit that it screwed up, in a major way, its investigation of the Alaska National Guard.
Okay, we're talking, though, about a completely separate case, right?
Right, but there's a connection. Judge Fifner cites an internal report that says an APD lieutenant was guilty of misconduct in the National Guard case. And this is the same lieutenant municipal attorneys called as their star witness in the first racial discrimination trial. By the time of the second trial, though, the lieutenant had been fired. The judge says the police department purposely stalled its investigation of the lieutenant's misconduct so he could testify against Kennedy and Feliciano in the first trial and still look credible. Fifner says Anchorage residents could conclude the city and its lawyers were more interested in winning the lawsuit than protecting them from sexual assault and drug dealing by members of the Alaska National Guard. Falsey, the municipal attorney, declined to issue any further comment about this. The APD also turned down requests for an interview. Legacki and others say the current mayoral administration or Anchorage Assembly should follow up on the judge's comments about the scandal. It's not clear if that'll happen, but we'll be continuing to follow this story.
Thanks for following this case for us, Casey, and giving us that update.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That was Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reporting. In order to survive, Sitka Community Hospital needs to overhaul how it does business. That's the message of an outside consultant to the Sitka Assembly as they grapple with the hospital's future management. KCAW's Emily Kwong reports.
So this is one of the swing beds.
CEO Rob Allen lowers his voice. We're entering the part of the hospital devoted to long-term care. The rooms are decorated with art and stuffed animals. One resident has propped a photo of Elvis against her window. And the reason Alan's taken me here is because changing how these beds are licensed could reap major financial reward for the hospital.
Take our 15 long-term care beds and put them into that same swing bed status. And it wouldn't change the way we provide care, but it would just change the regulations that we're working under.
Meaning patients wouldn't notice the difference and long-term care would continue, but the hospital would qualify for $1.1 million from Medicare. That's the estimate of Stroudwater Associates, a consultant hired to diagnose where the hospital could mop up some financial returns. Of all the suggestions in their 100-page report, this one is the most lucrative, but also the most technical.
For us, it's some paperwork, and we also need the state to go along with it.
Other changes don't require a rubber stamp from the state, but would change the hospital's relationship to family medicine, starting with the youngest. Vicki Akins is a labor and delivery nurse. Earlier this year, hospital leadership wrote it into the budget to discontinue the obstetrics program. Stroudwater supports the idea, estimating the financial impact to be $170,000. But it's hard to put a price on losing this option for childbirth in Sitka. Births at the hospital have declined from 60 in 2005 to 35 last year. That's part of the logic for cutting OB, but Akins has her own opinions on that.
In the lower 48, yes, OB units don't make money either. If we lost this unit, it would be a great loss to the community here.
Back in the hallway, Alan says he'll also be talking with Search next month to see if their family doctors can get credentialed to deliver babies across the bridge.
That's one of the advantages of having one spot, is that you can split that up among more doctors and they don't necessarily lose as many weekends to being on call.
Scheduling is also driving changes to surgery.
That's the clean area.
We pass by the surgical wing next, where Stroudwater says the hospital could save $190,000 by transitioning from a 24/7 operation to scheduled surgery 5 days a week. Amid these suggestions for where to cut, there's one area they want to see grow, and that's the clinic.
Hello.
Good morning.
Stroudwater has challenged the hospital to get 2,500 more patient visits to Mountainside Family Healthcare this year. Manager Patrick Williams believes it can grow by 5,000.
Every provider that we have has a waiting list, and we know people want to come in and be seen. I have calls every day. Can I get in? And we just don't have the room or the space available.
Which is why the hospital has been pushing the assembly for a modular unit, so they have more physical space to see patients. So that's the vision for the hospital, in a nutshell, that they presented to the assembly last week. Every department has been developing action plans to get the ball rolling. But is the hospital being outlined on paper one that patients would want to visit in person? At least one individual who is sitting in the audience at the presentation said no. This is Karen Lucas.
It seems to me the model they've presented would create a hospital that is an empty shell, a business, but that doesn't really provide the services that people need.
Nor does she want the hospital to merge with the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. Sitka was headed in that direction until two owners of a local hotel said they were interested in buying the hospital. What happens next is up to the Sitka Assembly. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
It looks like Bristol Bay fishermen will go home with a base price of $1 a pound after an unexpectedly huge run. That's up a quarter from last season, and with quality bonuses, the ex-vessel value is likely to be significantly higher than years past. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
The state estimated a Bristol Bay commercial sockeye harvest of around 27 million. Through Sunday, the harvest is already over 33 million. Andy Wink, a senior seafood analyst with the McDowell Group, says the market will probably welcome these extra wild-caught salmon.
Yeah, I think this is a year where the more fish, the better. Usually that's the case, but not every year.
One of those recent years where the extra fish was not good for the market was 2014. The Bristol Bay forecast came in much bigger than expected, one, but buyers were also waiting to see what would happen with Canada's Fraser River, which was supposed to be huge. Wink says while they waited, exchange rates fluctuated considerably.
So in 2014, there's this whole confluence of factors that led salmon prices much lower and, you know, just caused a real difficult situation in the market.
That year, processors say they lost their shirts, taking a big loss after they had paid their Bristol Bay fishermen a base price of $1.20 a pound.
That was kind of put on the fishermen the next year in 2015, which is why we saw such low prices that following year.
That was the infamous 50 cents a pound base price paid out in 2015. The market recovered the following year, and Wink says is now starved for the wild-caught sockeye Bristol Bay can provide in volume.
One thing that we've seen that is encouraging is that the number of U.S. grocery stores that are running ads and features on sockeye is up about 20% this year over last year. And so, you know, it's just kind of a data point that backs up what I've seen, you know, claims by retailers saying they're really, you know, pushing sockeye hard during this fresh season. And I think Kroger had said that was, you know, for the last few weeks, it's been their number one promotional item.
The amount of sockeye leaving Bristol Bay fresh has increased substantially and is a good trend, according to Wink. He says grocers and restaurants got a little hooked on the product when it was being offloaded at 2015 prices.
That really primed their interest the last few years. And I think the fishery is benefiting from that.
The base price of a dollar being offered, plus the quality bonuses that more and more the fleet are earning with chilled, floated, and bled sockeye, is going to translate into higher ex-vessel value this year. And with the bigger harvest, maybe by a big margin.
Even if no more fish are caught, it looks like we're going to be about $50 to $60 million above last year. Now, obviously, fishing is going to continue. And so I think there's a pretty good shot. Depending on what the average fish size is, we might be close to 2014 already. So, yeah, I mean, in this looks like the best year in a long, long time, since probably the early 90s.
And so far, no one seems sure just how big Bristol Bay 2017 will go. On Monday, just after things appeared to be slowing down, word was in that the Quijack River fish were finally showing up in big numbers. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
It appears numbers in the pink salmon season are settling back into a normal pattern. The pink season in the Gulf of Alaska was so bad in 2016, the federal government issued a disaster declaration for the fishery. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
The second week opener closed on a strong note. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Area Management biologist James Jackson says at the same time last year, fishermen had harvested around 200,000 pinks. This year, he says, they closed on July 17th with about 900,000 pinks. That's factoring in the odd and even years that characterize pink salmon's two-year life cycle, which Jackson says yield very different results in Kodiak. This is an odd year, which Jackson says comes with a five-year average of 26 million fish. Jackson says while the overall 2017 pink run forecast is 28 million pinks, Fish and Game is projecting a harvest of 20 million pinks based on numbers from the second opener. He says this year isn't as strong as 2015.
But we're pretty much catching the same numbers as 2013, which was also a good year. I mean, keep in mind, 2013, we caught 28 million pinks.
Jackson says the five-year average for even years is about 15 million, and last year's harvest was just 3 million. He says by the end of the third opener, Fish and Game should have a solid idea of what the run will look like. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
The Kuskokwim and Yukon rivers are having opposite experiences with king salmon this season. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
The Kuskokwim king salmon arrived late in a small trickle, and state biologists now say the run may meet escapement goals. Less than 60,000 kings are estimated to have passed the Bethel sonar station. To meet the lowest end of drainage-wide escapement, 65,000 kings would need to reach their spawning grounds. Meanwhile, the Yukon River kings arrived early and in the largest run observed in more than a decade. More than 250,000 kings have passed the lower river sonar site at Pilot Station. The run is expected to meet escapement goals and provide a larger subsistence harvest than last year. Some Yukon tributaries have already met escapement for kings. At others, high water is disrupting counting. The summer chum run on the Yukon is also having a banner year. More than 3 million summer chum have passed the lower river sonar station, far above historical numbers. Escapement goals for these fish are being met along the river. Starting today, chum salmon arriving in the Yukon will be considered fall chum. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Casey Grove and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.